Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. As voters in Indiana decide the fate of Ted Cruz's presidential campaign, we will begin with the blistering attack by Ted Cruz, who warned that, quote, if Indiana did not act, this country could well plunge into the abyss, calling Donald Trump a serial philanderer and a pathological liar after Trump had needled Cruz by suggesting his father, Raphael, was involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. Alan Schroeder, a professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University and author of Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House, joins us to discuss how reality television has taken over the presidential primary debates, with insults being hurled instead of chairs, and whether Trump will be able to needle Hillary Clinton with a barrage of tabloid smears and salacious scandal mongering that he is ready and waiting to level at her. Then on World Press Freedom Day, we will look into the irony that the same press that enabled the rise of Donald Trump to possibly become the next president of the United States with $2 billion worth of free publicity will face a president who refers to journalists as lying, disgusting people and vowed to make it easier to sue news organizations. Trevor Timm, a U.S. columnist with The Guardian and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, joins us to discuss how Trump, who appears to be a shapeshifter with no core beliefs, can both use the press and threaten its freedom. Then finally, we will speak with Tom Prodroni, a professor of sociology and director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project at Wayne State University, about the second day of the Teachers Sick Out that has closed 94 of Detroit's 97 public schools. He joins us to discuss how the same type of ideologically driven, numbers-crunching emergency managers appointed by the Republican governor who poisoned the children in nearby Flint, Michigan, have run Detroit's schools into the ground. And joining us now is Alan Schroeder, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. He's the author of several books, including Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, and Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. He's also written for Politico, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Schroeder.
Thank you very much.
And we seem to be on the cusp of having a celebrity in chief, not necessarily in the White House, but running as the Republican nominee. And today, in what most people are characterizing as an act of desperation, Ted Cruz in Indiana went after Donald Trump, calling him a pathological liar. He doesn't know the difference between the truth and lies. He lies practically every word that comes out of his mouth. He's a serial philanderer and a narcissist, which is hardly hardly a revelation, I would say. So that is the tenor of the debate. Now, you've followed presidential debates for a number of years. It seems to me that Donald Trump has literally changed the language. And this is a year in which politics, as usual, are out the window. And politicians, as usual, particularly status quo politicians, are simply in a position where they can't defend the indefensible.
Right, absolutely. And that's what makes it so interesting on the one hand and yet so frightening on the other. And it's particularly, you know, we're just seeing the Trump phenomenon lay waste to the traditional practice of politics and politicians who run against him not having any idea how to maneuver this landscape that he's created. And the Ted Cruz episode that you just described is great evidence of that.
So how is Hillary Clinton then going to handle it, assuming that she's the Democratic nominee?
Yeah, I think it's going to be tougher than her folks may realize, than she may realize, simply because of Trump's unpredictability. That always before in campaigns, there's been this kind of accepted roadmap of how campaigns evolve and what the boundaries are. And that just seems to have gone out the window. And I think particularly for Hillary Clinton, who's a fairly rigid person and someone who sort of likes that element of control, to put her up against someone who's the exact opposite of that and for whom you can't really prepare, I think that's going to be a really interesting and tricky challenge for her.
Well, Trump is already saying he can't wait to get Cruz out of the way, which certainly looks like what's happening
right
today in Indiana. so that he can move on to trash Hillary. So, you know, it's like a big battleship slowly turning its guns. You know?
Well, exactly. Although, to further that analogy, the enemy certainly sees him coming and is going to do everything, you know, within its grasp to counter that thing. And, of course, there's one advantage that Hillary has that the other opponents of Trump haven't had, and that is that she's got a roadmap in the sense of the past year, at least giving some sense of what she's up against. Now, you don't know exactly what he's going to do, and he keeps defying any kind of expectation, but at least there's, I don't think she'll be caught blindsided the way that, let's say, Jeb Bush was.
Well, it's, you know, there's what he's knocked off 17 people, I think, so far, or maybe it's 16, and Ted Cruz and Kasich about to be the, well, maybe it's 15, and Ted Cruz and Kasich are about to be 16 and 17. So his track record is pretty extraordinary. But in terms of creating a new kind of narrative, and the thing that I find extraordinary about him is how he's used the press and gotten something like $2 billion dollars worth of free advertising. The president even brought it up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner the other night and was quite critical of the press in sort of saying, thanks a lot, guys, you know. Well, he started out trying to promote his hotel business and look where he is now. This is something that in uncharted waters, how do you think they're going to navigate it from now on, given that the people like the owners of the press, the CBS head, said this may be bad for American democracy, but it's really great for CBS. That's the attitude of the owners of the press. Are they going to start showing some sort of sense of social responsibility? And because the more this guy becomes once he becomes a nominee of the Republican Party, I think a lot of what he said will be forgotten and forgiven, and they'll be treating him with even more deference.
Well, I wonder. I actually think that could play out either way, in the sense that any presidential nominee throughout history, once you become that nominee, the level of scrutiny just intensifies. And on the Hillary side, you know, she's been under that scrutiny already for so many years, but I think that there are probably some fresh things to turn up with regard to Trump that haven't been turned up. And I think once he is the nominee, which appears to be the case, that the press is going to intensify its efforts to dig up dirt on him. But you're absolutely right. I mean, he is a creature of the media. If you go back all the way to the 80s, when he came into the national spotlight initially, he is someone who has really flourished under the media spotlight, who has learned a great deal about how to navigate that spotlight and use it to his own advantage. But a presidential race and a presidential nominee is subject to a level of scrutiny that's unlike anything that Trump has experienced, even as a primary candidate. So I think that's going to be the key difference. And you're right, the earlier outrages are likely to be pushed aside and forgotten, but they'll be replaced by new outrages. Because if there's one thing we know about him, it's that he is a self-replenishing source of insults and attacks. And so I think there will always be a focus on that.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Schroeder, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. He's the author of several books, including Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, and Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. He's also written for Politico, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. Let's talk in terms of opposition research, Alan, which is an unfortunate tradition. The dark arts of politics, if you will, and everybody does it. They spend a lot of money, they send out private detectives, and they build up dossiers, and we've seen a number of candidates get nailed, Eagleton being the one that had been under psychiatric treatment, as an example. But you could, you know, you and I could do oppo research on Trump. It's all out there. Say, you know, for example, they were playing a clip today in relationship to Cruz's outbursts about Donald Trump being a serial philanderer. They had Donald Trump on the Howard Stern show, I think about 20 years ago, talking about all the women he'd bedded. And Donald Trump describes his battles with venereal disease as his own personal Vietnam, because he didn't serve in Vietnam. And Bill Clinton got him a lot of trouble for not serving in Vietnam, but not for comparing his battles with venereal disease to Vietnam. I mean, that it's an extraordinary thing. That would sink most people, but there it's on the record. I think it's going to nobody's going to bat an eyelid.
Well, perhaps not, simply because there's so much of it and it's so extreme. But on the other hand, if you think about the political challenge that faces Trump after he becomes the nominee, it's that he has to grow his support. And the question is, has he maxed out at that level at which he gains the nomination, but doesn't go beyond that? Because if he simply appeals to the traditional Republican base, or even just a segment of that Republican base, that is not enough to get him elected. And I think that's going to be the interesting political challenge for him, whether he can sort of see the need to tone himself down a little bit just to attract a wider range of support. But I don't know. I think he's one who is so unpredictable and really not totally in control of how he reacts to things that he may not be able to put the political side of that equation ahead of his personal feelings and his desire to sort of do things the way he's always done them.
But the Cruz meltdown today in Indiana, we ended up by saying if Indiana does not act, this country could well plunge into the abyss. He threw everything he could at Trump. And the suspicion is that Trump set him up by going on Fox News and accusing Rafael Cruz, the preacher who was Ted Cruz's father, of being involved in the assassination of JFK. He sort of repeated... His source, by the way, was the National Enquirer. But he basically repeated what the National Enquirer had said. And there's a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald when he was down campaigning for Castro's Cuba in New Orleans. And the guy standing next to him was alleged to be Ted Cruz's father, who apparently was a supporter of Castro initially when he came over here, but then turned against him, presumably when he discovered the Lord Jesus and made that sort of transgression into becoming an evangelical. But do you think that that's a possibility, that in other words, Trump could unhinge Hillary? That's what he does, doesn't he? He gets under their skin. It's calculated. It's not accidental.
Right, right. But there again, you know, Hillary has been subjected to so much over the past 25 years that it's so difficult to talk about Trump, you know, because you can't predict on the basis of any past history. But on her side, you know, she's a tough cookie, and she has had everything thrown at her for many, many years and is quite accustomed to being a target in a way that I think a Jeb Bush or a Ted Cruz or some of these other guys have not been. But Cruz is an interesting case here because, you know, where was this outrage a few months ago? Donald Trump has not changed his personality. He's not doing anything really different now than he was back last summer when he first started running. But Cruz really gave him a free pass. And there's been a lot of talk about how Cruz is this master strategist and has been playing the long game. And it's true, he's held out a lot longer than a lot of people thought he would. But he may have misread the basic thing here, which was the need to kind of dispatch Trump much earlier before he became this this inevitable, you know, sort of monster, so to speak, that he has become. So I think a lot of this is on Cruz. It's interesting that Cruz is only now at this final moment really having this reaction that he might well have had many months ago.
Well, both CNN and MSNBC were playing clips of Cruz early in the campaign when he was sort of sidling up to Donald while Donald was trashing everybody else, in particular Jeb Bush, and that would have been the time for the rest of the guys on that stage and the girl to unite. But Ted Cruz was the traitor. He was Donald was his best friend. That was his strategy.
Absolutely. And even today, I found it quite interesting that when asked specifically, "Will you support Donald Trump if he becomes the nominee?" Ted Cruz did not offer an answer of any kind there. So he certainly didn't rule it out, despite his anger, despite all these protestations. So that's what's a kind of an interesting side aspect of this. All the people that are now coming out against Trump on the Republican side, and yet who will not commit to voting against him.
Well, that would indicate that this guy, talk about accusing Trump of being amoral. I mean, this would be the height of amorality, wouldn't it be, to to basically call him your best friend when he's trashing everybody else, and that would have been the time for all of the other candidates to unite and dispatch him so that this whole election season wouldn't be this ugly slugfest that it became. But then now that he's about to be dispatched by Trump, he then suddenly turns on him. But at the end of the day, he doesn't want to alienate him totally because he wants a job. I mean, the whole thing is so craven.
Well, it is. And not only perhaps wants a job, but is also looking at the 2020 calendar already and thinking, okay, Trump's going to lose in 2016, and there's going to be an opening for another Republican to come in and save the day 4 years hence. And, you know, I think all of these guys, that's one reason that they're extraordinarily nervous about Trump's support and his supporters, because they're thinking to their own careers and that they may very well meet these people one of these days.
So let's talk a bit about your book, Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. And I recall James Carville's famous line that politics is show business for ugly people. And yet we've had a very telegenic presidents, starting with Jack Kennedy, who won the debates against Nixon largely because he is more telegenic. And then Bill Clinton clearly had a skill with the press. No question that Obama does. It's just, he's a natural. He's a performer. Reagan, of course, was an actor, a trained actor. You wonder at the end of the day whether it's going to be the Republican actor versus the Democratic actor, that we've sort of morphed from a kind of game show democracy into a reality show democracy. And nobody can argue that Donald Trump didn't have a lot of media training with his show The Apprentice. So is that what it comes down to, that we really, all of those presidents that people say were great presidents, like Lincoln, particularly George Washington, the founder of this country, he had wooden teeth and spoke with a kind of lisp because the wind was whistling through his wooden teeth. I mean, he wouldn't have lasted a second in the TV age. Neither would Abe Lincoln, you know. So walk us through that insanity.
Well, you know, it is a bit of insanity, although the reality is that communicating to the public, to the voters, is a large part of the president's portfolio in modern times. And the way that you do that is through the lens of the camera and the microphone. And so to not have that skill is to be missing a very basic part of the overall job requirement. And, you know, it's Hillary here is serves as a useful example, because it's a part of the job that is not something that comes naturally to her. And she has suffered as a result of that, because she doesn't love that piece of the description. And yet you can't only have that. You know, Reagan had been an actor, but of course he'd also been the governor of California. And if you go back and read the things that he was writing in the 50s and 60s before he was elected president, he was he really gave a lot of thought to issues in a way that Donald Trump certainly has not. So, you know, I like your comment about this is now morphing from a kind of an acting challenge to a reality television challenge, because that is the wrinkle here, is that Reagan was able to deploy all of those tricks he learned in Hollywood to use the camera and the microphone to put his message across. But it was a different, in a way, more innocent time, and reality television is much more brash, much more in your face, requires a different set of skills, mostly involving your ability to draw attention to yourself. So times have changed, but I think any candidate in the modern age had better figure you've got to be good on TV or you're not going to get very far.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Alan Schroeder. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ian. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Schroeder, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. He's the author of several books, including Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, and Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. He's also written for Politico, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. We can take a brief station break. We'll be back on World Press Freedom Day, looking into the irony that the same press that enabled the rise of Donald Trump is being threatened by him.
Come on now, who do you, who do you, who do you, who do you think you are? Bless your soul. You really think you're in control? I think you're crazy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Trevor Timm, who is a U.S. columnist with The Guardian and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, a nonprofit that supports and defends journalism dedicated to transparency and accountability. His latest article at The Guardian is "Donald Trump's Views Are Impossible to Discern. Why Pretend Otherwise?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Trevor Timm.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And it occurs to me that it's something of a massive irony that on World Press Freedom Day, the same press that enabled the rise of Donald Trump to possibly become the next president of the United States with $2 billion worth of free publicity could face a president who refers to journalists as lying, disgusting people and has vowed to strengthen libel laws to make it easier to sue news organizations. So, you know, the press, they're enabling somebody effectively who's threatening their freedom.
Yes, it certainly is ironic. I mean, since the start of this campaign, you know, I've lost count of the amount of times that Trump has threatened to sue major news organizations over stories they were about to run on him. You know, luckily in the United States, we do have strong libel laws. Or at least the First Amendment protects news organizations from a lot of libel suits. And Donald Trump has threatened to change the laws, as he says, to make it easier for people to sue news organizations who are reporting on public figures. The real ironic part, though, is that no one benefits more from our First Amendment than Donald Trump. You know, every day he's on Twitter throwing insult after insult, making up things about different candidates, and generally being offensive to a lot of people. Yet his speech is just as protected as everybody else's. So, the good news is that even if he does become president, which I think is still a long shot, despite him winning the Republican nomination, that he'll have a very, very hard time changing libel laws to make it easier to sue, because there actually is no national libel law. Libel law is covered by the First Amendment, and so he would actually have to repeal that to get anywhere.
Well, it turns out that this flap today with Ted Cruz going after Trump in Indiana and suggesting that if the Indianans don't vote the right way, the country's going to fall into the abyss, he is probably was needled by Trump, who went on Fox News saying that Cruz's father, Rafael, was somehow involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. You kind of have a feeling that there was a connection there. But it turns out that Trump is very close friends with David Pecker, the CEO of the National Enquirer, and possibly has been using the National Enquirer to float these sort of salacious tabloid scandal fabrications. I think largely they are. And it's not the first time it's happened. So, again, there's no question. This guy knows how to use the press.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he has used the press, I don't think anybody can argue, much, much better than any other candidate, while at the same time continuously insulting them at his campaign rallies, as you mentioned before, calling them all sorts of names. He keeps the press penned up in this press pen at all of his rallies. He's been known to have the Secret Service keep them from leaving and going out into the regular crowd. There was also an incident where a Secret Service member actually assaulted a Time photographer at a Trump event. And then, of course, his campaign manager was accused of assaulting another reporter. So there is certainly this massive hostility in the Trump campaign for the press, yet they would not exist without them.
So in your article at The Guardian, Trevor Timm, you say that Trump's a shapeshifter with no core belief systems. And I think you provide an extraordinary amount of evidence. Why then would somebody, as you mentioned, somebody like Maureen Dowd with The New York Times, a very well-known columnist, make these extraordinary, almost apologies for this guy's erratic and nonsensical foreign policy? I know she has a sort of pathological hatred of the Clintons. But I understand the Huffington Post has tried to deal with this dilemma that the more that he becomes likely to be a presidential candidate, the more the tendency will be to forget and forgive all of those terrible things that he said about people and different ethnic groups and Muslims, etc. They have a little kind of disclaimer at the end of articles about him. But what explains that kind of acceptance? Or are you afraid that there will be an acceptance of him and the context of who he is and what he said will be forgotten?
Well, I think at least on Maureen Dowd's part, it was part laziness. I mean, Trump has been going around saying over and over again that he opposed the Iraq war before it started. You know, for a long time, we weren't sure if that was true or not because no one could find any comments of him going for or against. But at least a few months ago, we have documented evidence that Donald Trump actually did support the Iraq war before it started. And yet he's gone on saying that he didn't, even though we know that's not the case. And that's basically his MO, where he will just repeat a lie over and over and over again until people believe it's the truth. And so if journalists aren't careful and don't actually look up what he says and try to figure out if he's making another bald-faced lie, then it's going to slip by and then people are going to start believing it more and more again. And, you know, you can go right down the list. You know, Donald Trump has, this has happened to him over and over and over again. You know, he said he was for, or he said he was against the military intervention in Libya in 2011. In fact, he was for it. You know, he said that he was against overthrowing a dictator in Egypt. Actually, he was for that in 2011. And you look at every single issue, it's the exact same thing, whether it's just lying about what he believes, or going from one position to the complete opposite, sometimes within the same day.
And again, I'm speaking with Trevor Timm, who is a U.S. columnist with The Guardian and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, a nonprofit that supports and defends journalism dedicated to transparency and accountability. His latest article at The Guardian is Donald Trump's Views Are Impossible to Discern, Why Pretend Otherwise? So in terms of World Press Freedom Day, in your organization, it does strike me, again, I mean, I get a lot of mail from listeners saying, why do you keep talking about this guy Trump? Well, in effect, by us talking about him, we're only, you know, furthering his kind of capture of the press, if you will. But on the other hand, he is poised to be the Republican nominee and could possibly become the next president of the United States. But there's no question that this is a different kind of candidate in terms of foreign policy, notwithstanding Maureen Dowd's deficiencies there. You know, he's more akin to a kind of Putin or Erdogan, that kind of dictator, because he doesn't appear to have any kind of foreign policy compass or any moral core. But the idea that he thinks he can buddy up to Putin, he's buddying up to a guy who on World Press Freedom Day, I think, is the poster boy for all that's wrong with those that basically destroy press freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, at the same time, this is, again goes back to the complete contradictions of Donald Trump. And by the way, I agree. I don't think there's any way that the media can stop covering Trump, they can stop talking about him. He is going to be the Republican nomination, and that is news in itself. And they shouldn't shy away from that. But I think what they should shy away from is this lazy reporting where they're just repeating what Trump is saying as if it is actually true when we know it's not. You know, he has all sorts of contradictions in the way he talks about foreign policy. You know, in his foreign policy speech, he was talking about how he doesn't want to start any more wars in the Middle East, yet he's, you know, talked about how he wants to bomb the hell out of certain countries in the Middle East, how he wants to bring back torture, how he wants to kill terrorists' families. And so this is not a man that is, you know, set on peace and prosperity for all throughout the world. He's, you know, unpredictable and chaotic. And the fact that he's one of two people left in the presidential race, I think, terrifies a lot of people, rightly.
Well, to some extent, the Republican Party is sort of reaping the whirlwind of what it's sown in terms of coded dog whistle racial politics, and in particular, this hammering forever about the idea of the liberal press, this canard that there's such a thing as a liberal press, and being with Pacifica Radio, I know that's about as liberal or left as you can get in this country. And there's no question that it has very, very few listeners and very little influence in the press compared, say, to Fox News. So the whole thing is a massive, you know, bad joke to my mind, but it nevertheless has caught on. And isn't this a lot of what Trump's doing, basically playing to the sort of bread and circuses of his own followers who really hate the press? I mean, they hate the press, and I'm not entirely sure why.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, all of these Republicans are now coming out and saying how they, you know, aren't going to vote for Trump, and they think he's a danger to the party. But they have nothing, no one to blame but themselves. You know, Trump is really, he's not really an anomaly in the Republican Party. He's basically Frankenstein's monster. He's taken all of their issues and all of their opinions that they've had for the past 5 or 10 years, where they've tried to, you know, under the radar with dog whistles, as you said, kind of stoke racial animosity, to pit the classes against each other, and has really, you know, taken the enamel off of those positions that had been, you know, so masked by language, and has really put them out in the open. And so, you know, torture is a great example. You know, Republicans always say that the U.S. never tortures, yet then goes about and does all these actions, which obviously do constitute torture. Trump just rips the mask off of that and says, actually, no, I am for torture, and I'm going to do waterboarding or worse. He's basically just taking the positions they've already had and kind of actually, in an ironic way, sprinkling a grain of truth on them. And it can certainly be horrifying to a lot of people, but I do think it is important to understand that this is, you know, the Republicans are reaping what they sow.
So what can the press do? Obviously, the president the other night at the White House Correspondents' Dinner needled the press over, said basically, you know, Donald Trump started out his campaign to promote his hotel business, and thanks to you guys in the press, look where he is today. And I think that's a very, that point is well taken. But what can be done to repair? I mean, we were just saying a minute ago that you can't avoid covering the guy. But how do you contextualize it? And how do you have a kind of war room like they had the first Clinton campaign had that just does fact checking every day that, you know, he said, this is what he said today, but this is actually what he said before and expose the serial liar?
Yeah, I mean, I think that fact checking and calling out lies when they're lies is incredibly important. And that, you know, like we said before, that the press can't stop covering him. But I also think that, you know, in some ways, the message is getting out, and in some cases, the press actually is doing their job. I think that, you know, we get caught up in the hype of these presidential primaries, but we have to remember that, you know, the Republican Party, only 25% or so of the American public is registered Republican, and only about half of those people are voting for Donald Trump. You know, with the rest of the country, he is almost historically unpopular, you know, having, you know, 70% disapproval ratings. And so when we get to the general election, you know, we might find that the country turns against him even more. And despite the fact that he was able to come up through the Republican Party, which again has been kind of, you know, churning and promoting the same type of issues that Donald Trump has been in the last few months, they've been doing it for years. You know, outside the Republican Party, hopefully the United States and the world will completely reject him.
Well, there is a tactic, though, by sort of turning our politics into reality TV and, you know, hurling insults and lowering the tone to the point where he's actually created a new narrative. And, you know, traditional politicians clearly can't handle it. He's just knocked them off one by one. And on Monday, Trump had lunch in Indianapolis with Ed Klein, the author of these scandal-mongering books about the Clintons that, you know, fact-free but salacious. So could he possibly just hammer her to the point where not only would be some of the potential voters disappointed and wanted to vote for Bernie Sanders, but assuming she can win the Sanders people over, would just the barrage of negativity from Trump just basically turn everybody off? Because that, after all, is the fundamental tactic behind negative advertising.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, Trump is in some ways a brilliant tactician as far as his ability to counterpunch and insult candidates and drive down their negatives to the point where voters don't like them anymore. I certainly think that there is still a risk the exact scenario you described happens in the general election. I don't think it's likely, but I also don't think that people shouldn't take it seriously. And that they shouldn't be trying to understand that is coming and try to fight against it as much as possible. That's certainly a tactic that's been used in past elections, and there's no one better than Trump. And so it's not that people shouldn't be worried. I just think that there's also the case that we do have to look at how the general public has reacted to Trump so far. And overall, when you're counting the entire population and not just Republicans, he still is to this day incredibly unpopular.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Trevor Timm.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Trevor Timm, who is a U.S. columnist with The Guardian and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, a nonprofit that supports and defends journalism dedicated to transparency and accountability. His latest article at The Guardian is "Donald Trump's Views Are Impossible to Discern. Why Pretend Otherwise?"
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
And teach your parents well. The children's hell will slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Tom Pedroni, who's a professor of curriculum studies and policy sociology at Wayne State University and director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project. He's the author of Market Movements, African American Involvement in School Voucher Reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Pedroni.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Ian.
And Tom, when you use the word reform in the context of school voucher reform, is there some irony there? Because isn't that a pretty contentious notion that vouchers don't necessarily reform schools? They to completely defund public schools in order to fund private schools.
That's right, absolutely. And the word reform has really become contorted over these last few decades. That book was written in 2007, so the resonance of the term was a little bit different. But my point in that book was to listen to African American families who were using vouchers to get a sense of how exactly this very unlikely coalition with far right-wing funders like the Bradley Foundation, who after all funded works like The Bell Curve, which purported that African Americans and Latinos were biologically intellectually inferior to European Americans and Asians. So I, in the book, was looking at the nature of that very unusual coalition.
Well, we've seen what's happened when Republican free market ideologues and Christian fundamentalists take over states. In the case of Kansas, under Senator Brownback, now Governor Brownback, he's all but bankrupted the state and destroyed the school system. And the same is happening in Indiana with Mike Pence, who is a very devout evangelical, and he's put in a voucher program, which the citizens of Indiana are now starting to wake up to, because their schools are being defunded and stripped bare with taxpayer money going to Christian independent private schools, where many of the students come from very wealthy families, which the residents of the state are subsidizing. So this mania is taking hold in a lot of places. And I understand in Michigan, you also have an ideologue as a governor who is also a former venture capitalist. And he has sort of brought to the table all of this sort of bean counting, profit and loss sort of mania, where he's appointed all these emergency managers, both for Detroit and we know for Flint, where they poisoned the water. So the thing that drives me nuts is that in this country, the debates on the Republican side are about whether kids are going to go into a toilet as straight and come out gay in a public toilet, and that's their obsession. But what about poisoning a bunch of kids in Flint, Michigan? Isn't that something we should really be talking about and dealing with instead of this sort of hypothetical idea that there are all these transgender predators out there waiting in public toilets?
Well, absolutely. We all know how those moral panics work on a national scale, right? And we should be absolutely horrified by what has happened in Flint and it's happening in Detroit. Obviously, there's the immediate terror that residents are living with of knowing that their water is still not clean, that their children have been poisoned with lead and a number of other chemicals and substances, and the fact that a lot of parents are traumatized by the fact that they were an agent in bringing this water to their own children who have been so adversely affected. It's actually a very fitting metaphor to speak about the Detroit situation. And so if you live in Michigan and you're African American, just a few years ago, there was a more than 50% chance that you did not have any empowered elected officials. We have an emergency manager law in Michigan that is unlike anything in the rest of the country, and it gives the governor-appointed emergency manager unprecedented powers in breaking union contracts, in closing schools, in breaking other contracts, in reforming school district boundaries. The powers are just immense. I mean, what it really is a gutting of any notion of checks and balances, even on whether we're talking about the state level or the local level. But what it is particularly meant is an utter dissolution of African-American voting rights and African-American control over their communities, whether it's emergency management appointed over cities as in Flint or over school districts as you still have in the Detroit public schools now. And under that state control, the results have been absolutely devastating in terms of the financial malfeasance and the corruption, in terms of the weakening academic results, the utter destruction of a public school district that as recently as 18 years ago was a district that was located in a very hard-set community that was set upon Detroit by deindustrialization, by capital flight, by white flight, by middle-class black flight, by state disinvestment, by federal disinvestment, yet still in the midst of all that was admired nationally for the results it was able to bring, the kind of school experiences was able to bring to mostly African-American children. But things have gone tremendously downhill since then. And we can't help thinking that it's not the worst thing in the world for those who use the rhetoric of free markets to trumpet charter schools, which in Michigan, 80% of those are for-profit charter schools. So there's immense profit to be made off of black bodies, off of the per-pupil funds that in Michigan follow black bodies, either into the charter school or if they remain in the regular public school, there's all the money that can be had through relationships with software vendors and consultants and other things of this nature.
And again, I'm speaking with Tom Pedroni, who's a professor of curriculum studies and policy sociology at Wayne State University and director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project. So you've also got on top of the mix, you've got all these sort of meddling billionaires like Eli Broad and the Gates and others who may well have noble motives, but they seem to have missed they seem to have missed the broader point, which is that it's just there's a simple logic to this. If you defund public education in order to provide vouchers for private education, what happens to the vestiges of public education? And haven't we, you know, they say they're trying to solve a problem by creating the problem itself, or by exacerbating the problem, which is, you know, defunding the very thing that you say is broken. Why not invest in something that's broken as opposed to strip it bare and ship all the funds to these for-profit and particularly these Christian schools who, you know, don't teach evolution, and you'd think that people like Gates and others that from the high-tech world would at least understand the anti-science bias is not helpful for America's future. But in any case, let's talk about this particular case here. You're on the second day of the strikes. Not a strike, by the way. It's illegal for teachers to strike in the state of Michigan, but it is a sick out. It's the second day, and they've closed 94 of the district's 97 schools have been shut down. But since 2009, these series of emergency managers have taken over the school district. And my understanding is that before the emergency managers took over the school district actually had a surplus, and now it is, you know, devastatingly broke.
Yeah, well, here's how that looks, Ian. There have been actually two separate state takeovers, one after the other, in Detroit. The first came in 1999 under the Governor Engler administration, which remains one of the largest promoters of the charter school industry in the country. So we had a takeover in 1999 that lasted until 2006. And then we had a second takeover under emergency management from 2009 until the present day. So the district has been under state control for 14 of the last 17 years. It was in 1999, before the first state takeover, that the district controlled by the elected board had a positive operating fund balance of $93 million, was, despite the industrialization and the flight that we spoke about in Detroit, was gaining on all the state averages on the mandated tests. Not that I'm a tremendous believer in those tests, but nevertheless, it's a measuring stick they often use. And had in social studies, the area in which I was a public school teacher, actually passed the state average. And you have to think about how remarkable that was, given the plight that Detroit was already facing structurally at that time. And we know about the intimate relationship between structural malaise and what happens in the school, in the classroom. So, yes, we had a very whole district that was admired by urban districts across the country. There were regular tours of the district to highlight what was being done. And the district was taken over. And we can't help noticing that the district was thrown within a few years into total disarray that involved excessive spending, lopsided spending. For example, the school administration was located in a building that it owned that was quite usable. And instead, the district decided under the first state takeover to buy four floors of a prominent building here, the Fisher Building, for several million dollars more than that very building had sold in its entirety for just a year earlier. So you had a lot of inept fiscal management. You had a lot of corruption. And so within a few short years, you had parents who were fleeing the public schools for charter schools. You had a decline in academic performance, and this began a downward spiral from which the district has never been able to recover, a downward spiral of decreasing enrollment, which has led to decreasing finances, which has led to budget cuts, which has led to worse academic performance, which has led to school closures, which has led to more people leaving the district. It's a very difficult spiral to recover from, and we can't help noticing that the primary beneficiary during that time and to the present day has been the charter school industry. So Engler was both a proponent for the charter schools that were setting up shop in Detroit at the same time that he controlled the school district and sent it into a nosedive. And that's where we are today with the I need to point out that the teachers don't even call them sick outs. What the teachers call this is a lockout. They say if they're not being paid for their work and their pay would have ended last Thursday, then really it's a lockout. They're being kept from working for pay. So yes, today was the second day, and the manipulation of teachers is simply amazing, because what teachers are expected to do now in order to get the money in their pay that they've already been promised is advocate for the passage of the governor's plan for again restructuring the public schools. The very gentleman who has put us in crisis with a series of emergency managers now wants to compel teachers, if you want to get paid, you better get, you know, to the legislature and demand that they pass my package of bills to get the money to you. It's unbelievable what can happen in black cities like this in the United States.
But also, when you talk about corruption, my understanding is that the city of Detroit, I think one of the mayors was went to jail, but the treasurer, did he not make all these incredibly bad deals with Wall Street and then ended up working for a Wall Street bank?
Yeah, there's been a lot of that, right? There's been a lot of corruption in city governments, both during emergency management of the city, which has we've also had, and before. And there have been some remarkably bad deals that our cities have engaged in with credit default swaps that have put them into the circumstances that they are currently in. That's absolutely correct.
Right. And, but when you talk about the parental flight from the Detroit public schools, they had 150,415 students in 2003-2004. Now there are about 46,000 students attend the district's 97 schools. So that is pretty stark evidence of you know. And so, again, you know, you wonder about how these ideologues. I mean, I don't know how Snyder can look himself in the mirror after what he's done to the children of Flint, but you know, he's there. Looking sort of earnest and carrying on as usual, and his peak, and you know, isn't it about the Republicans control the rural areas and the cities are Democrat and the rural areas own both of the houses since they're dominated by Republicans, and there's essentially a sort of political punishment going on here.
I think that is happening, but I want to also say that in addition to that we do have the phenomena. That the very emergency manager law that resulted in the situation in Flint with the poisoning of children and also in Detroit and what has happened with the public schools, that emergency manager law was defeated after a massive public campaign, a referendum campaign. The law was repealed by the voters, which is something that happens here in Michigan. And in that repeal, in that vote, 87 of our 91 counties voted against the emergency manager law. So that would include a lot of those rural counties, those Tea Party counties. And I imagine it's a lot there about local control and keep your state government out of my schools and that sort of thing. But, of course, what happened then, and the reason why we remain in this disastrous situation in both Flint and Detroit, is that within weeks of the electorate throwing this law out, the governor simply introduced a new law that was almost identical, but attached an appropriation to the new law, which in Michigan made it referendum proof. And here we are today.
So what's it going to take then if you've got the flight of parents? And I wonder if there's we know that much of the city suffered tremendously in the 2008 crash.
Yes.
There's apparently vast areas of empty houses. What's your sense then of how you can make a political comeback? Because it really is, I think, a case of rural Tea Party type Republicans punishing urban Democrats, most of whom are black.
Yes, that's true. And it's really hard, and I will answer your question directly, it's really hard to watch the testimony that we saw today in the state legislature, where one Republican legislator after another spoke about the need to punish Detroiters, those black folks who they believe are not capable of self-governance. They don't say it this way, of course, but for the actions that they've taken, they believe that have led Detroit into this circumstance. So they say, and you know, it was difficult to watch earlier today. I'm on the west side of the state. We balance our budgets in the schools. We don't get into situations like this. And the incredible irony, and they say, why should the state bail out the district. And, of course, the incredible irony is it wasn't local control by African Americans that produced this. It was the state's malfeasance, much of it likely intentional, that produced this. And a Republican legislature and a Republican governor under which this happened. And they seem to speak without any irony at all about castigating African Americans for poorly managing their finances when that power had already been taken away under a kind of slaveholder mentality that said it's really better if whites from Lansing govern the situation in Detroit rather than allowing African Americans to make those sorts of decisions over their district themselves. So to answer your question more directly, I think that one of the crucial steps will be to re-empower an elected board, because like in Flint, what we see in Detroit is evidence that every step of along the way to the tragedy that we're in, local elected officials who were disempowered and community activists who had no venue through which to express themselves in a way that could actually lead to substantive adjustments in policy, that those people were calling for accountability, were calling for a stoppage to what was occurring, if they had absolutely no voice because of the emergency manager law. And so that's why we're talking in Flint, for example, about why the governor says he didn't know anything, even though his cabinet apparently knew, and why people, bureaucrats, were not sharing information with him. There was no democratic structure in place to take any citizens seriously about the concerns that they were raising when they were accurate. And also scientists were raising. The same thing has happened in Detroit with the public schools. We can see where members of the elected board tried to stop corruption scandals. We had Eli Broad is all over Detroit. He grew up in Detroit, and he has funded many of the emergency managers. He's funded a separate district, which has been absolutely calamitous for Detroit's children and rife with corruption. Robert Bob, who was the first emergency manager who was recommended by Eli Broad to the governor at that time, someone was put in place as the number two to Robert Bob, Barbara Bird Bennett, who you might remember from a tremendous scandal in Chicago just a few months ago, where she has now confessed to a felony of a kickback scheme involving $20 to $30 million. Well, before she came to Chicago, she was here in Detroit, and she engineered at that time a $40 million textbook deal with her immediate past employer, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, where she had served as superintendent in residence. And I looked back through the elected, because the elected board still meets even though they have no power, and there they were saying, no, you should follow our academic plan, not the academic plan of Barbara Bird Bennett, which seems to have no substance other than wanting to pay out a huge check to buy a bunch of textbooks.
Well, Tom Pedroni, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Tom Pedroni, who's a professor of curriculum studies and policy sociology at Wayne State University and director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project. He's the author of Market Movements, African-American Involvement in School Voucher Reform. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.